You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In its relatively short existence, WikiLeaks has had an outsized impact on global affairs and as a result quickly became a lightning rod of controversy. In his latest film, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, Academy Award-winning director Alex Gibney looks at the people behind the organization, especially Julian Assange, its enigmatic founder, and tells the story of the largest information leaks in the history of the United States government. The film opens this Friday, and I'm very pleased to welcome Alex Gibney back to our program. Hello.
Hi, Len. Good
Where's
to be
it
here.
Opening?
At the Angelica and Lincoln Center, Eleanor Bunin Theater, I think.
Where does the first part of your title, We Steal Secrets, come from?
It's actually a quote from an unexpected source, from Michael Hayden.
Not Julian Assange?
No, from Michael Hayden, former head of this NSA and CIA. And he leans forward in his chair and says, you know what, Alex? We steal secrets. That's what we, meaning the United States government, does. And so it puts the whole context of secrets and leaking in a different kind of perspective.
And he takes some odd positions in all of this. You're not sure whether, to some degree, he even sympathized at times with WikiLeaks. Of course, they were his arch nemesis.
I'm not sure that he does sympathize at all with WikiLeaks, talking about Michael Hayden. But it it is odd that he doesn't see the irony of his own position.
As a result of the release of the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs, as well as the State Department diplomatic cables, WikiLeaks is responsible for the largest security breach in United States history. What is all, has all of that information taught the public about the world we live in?
I think it's taught us a tremendous amount, really. It's so much that we're still really digesting it. There are still WikiLeaks cables that people are pouring through and finding background to situations all over the world that we didn't know about before. And in the case of the war logs, the Iraq and Afghan war logs, it taught us a lot about what was really going on in those wars, how much higher the civilian casualties were than what we were being told. There was complicity in torture by the Bush and Obama administrations in Iraq. There was and also the revelations of secret assassination squads. And I think in terms of the State Department cables, there was also a sense of what was really going on with the tyrannies in the Middle East that ultimately would lead to the Arab Spring. That was probably the biggest thing.
Some people see WikiLeaks and Julian Assange as heroic. Others have suggested that he should be in jail along with Bradley Manning, or on Fox News they said he should be killed by a drone strike. Did your view of Assange and WikiLeaks change over the course of putting this film together?
It did, but not in a way that would be consistent with what those people were saying. As a publisher, I don't have any issue with WikiLeaks whatsoever, with one exception. What they did was to publish material, and in that sense, they're not unlike the New York Times or the Guardian. The one exception is that they're not fond of redactions, which are sometimes necessary in order to protect innocent informants who may be badly hurt if their names are published. They weren't in this case, but they could have been.
Now, so nobody was hurt by the fact that their names were revealed. But is this the same thing as journalism?
No, I wouldn't say it's the same thing, but it's the same thing really as publishing. And I think, Assange would make the argument, and I think correctly, that what he's doing is publishing documents that need to be seen in order to properly understand the way the world works. In that context, I think WikiLeaks is a viable publisher.
It has had a meteoric rise from being a group that was popular on the hacker convention circuit to a household name that has influenced global affairs. How did WikiLeaks get its start?
Well, WikiLeaks got its start because Julian Assange wanted it to be a leaking organization.
So it's totally his creation?
It is, very much his creation. I think you really can't separate Julian Assange from WikiLeaks. He's always had a board. He's always had other people who are involved. And at times, he tries to present to the world this idea that it's some huge organization. It reminded me of a guy I used to know who, when he went on his own, used to call his office, quote unquote, and you would hear things like, for the accounting department, press 1. All the calls went to him, of course. So that's a little bit what WikiLeaks was like.
So it was three or four people and a bunch of volunteers.
Correct.
Before he launched WikiLeaks, hadn't Assange made a name for himself as a hacker in Australia?
He had. He had been tried in Australia for penetrating U.S. government and also other corporate websites or, you know, materials, and was held to account for it in Australia and ultimately convicted.
In NASA? He went after NASA?
Well, the NASA thing is unclear. You're referring to what's called the Wankworm affair, in which on the verge of launching this Galileo space probe, which was nuclear-powered, a lot of activists were very concerned. And just as the thing was about to launch, suddenly on all the NASA or on many of the NASA computer screens came up the word WANK, Worms Against Nuclear Killers. And it was a computer worm which travels from computer to computer without, you know, the computer people being able to stop it. And nobody had ever seen that before. Ultimately, they were able to trace the origin of that worm to Australia. Julian has always been very coy about that. He's neither accepted nor denied responsibility.
He used the name Mendax at the time. How significant is that name?
I think it ultimately becomes very significant. Mendax is short for Splendide Mendax, which is a phrase from the Latin poet Horace. And it means nobly untruthful or noble liar. And I think ultimately it came to be true with Julian. And I suppose, you know, we can credit him for giving us advance warning that that's where he was going.
Although at the beginning, he always tries to present himself as somebody who's just for truth.
Correct. You know, speaking truth to power. And I think for a lot of the film and for a lot of his career, Julian was that guy.
And early in the film, Assange declares that he likes crushing bastards. Do you think that he is an idealist, or is he an egoist or something else?
Well, I think he may be both. But he certainly is an idealist in that sense. And I think that he does have an anti-authoritarian streak, which I actually admire. You know, there are a lot of people who suck up and kick down. I always thought of myself as kicking up and sucking down. And I think Assange may share that trait.
Would you describe his politics as libertarian, anarchist, left of center?
Maybe left of center, but I don't think entirely left of center. I think anti-authoritarian would probably be as close as I would come to that.
To many people, Julian Assange is a rock star. Is it your sense that he always wanted to be famous?
I do get that sense. I mean, you get that sense going back. You know, interesting, there is a journalist filmmaker named Mark Davis who notes that even before he was the subject of attacks by the United States government, he would go all over the world, you know, constantly changing SIM cards in his phone and trying to elude people who were following him when no one was following him. So in that sense, I think he always imagined himself to be an enemy of the state before he was one.
He didn't want to cooperate with you, did he?
He didn't. I mean, I went through a long period of time. It was an agonizingly long period where I met with him a number of times. I went to his 40th birthday party. And one of my executive producers, Jemima Khan, put up the money or some of the money for his bond. But at the end of the day, after a very long 6-hour negotiation, it came to naught.
What was the party like?
Party was amusing. It was good. They held a rather impromptu auction, silent auction for WikiLeaks, which in which there were a lot of autographed copies of WikiLeaks cables.
My guest is Alex Gibney. His latest film is We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is in a very weakened position from where it was just a few years ago. The group has had financial problems, and last year Assange sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in order to avoid being extradited to Sweden, where he's accused of having committed sexual assault. Do you think that WikiLeaks will be able to survive?
Hard to know. I mean, they collated some recent National Archives materials on Henry Kissinger, which is it's a perfectly valuable thing to have done. I think they'll have some impact in the future, but I think the larger impact of WikiLeaks is metaphorical. That is to say, it's the idea of this kind of publishing organization that publishes transnationally that I think is important.
Well, does he believe that all information should be in the public domain, regardless of its potential costs?
I think he does. I mean, there are times when he's modulated that view, but there are also times he's said publicly, and we quote some of those instances in the film, in which he says, even in the case where people might be harmed, like revealing secrets about an anthrax attack, you know, that he would do it because it's more important to be an absolutist in this kind of leaking mechanism.
Well, you mentioned that earlier in his career he almost seemed paranoid about people going after him. But haven't there been attacks by the U.S. government on him?
Not attacks, but there have been certainly public attacks on television by mm-hmm. prominent political figures. But I like to think of the words of Hunter Thompson in this regard. He said, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean I don't have enemies.
Assange and WikiLeaks would have received as much attention were it not for Bradley Manning. Why did Manning, who comes across as a very troubled soul, join the military in the first place? And how did he wind up in Iraq?
Well, I think Bradley Manning wanted an education. He came from Crescent, Oklahoma. He was poor. I think he wanted to go to college. And that's why he joined the military.
But he had a lot of skill with computers.
He did, a lot of skill with computers, and that turned out to be very valuable. And even though they were about to flush him out of the system, he was in a discharge unit, I think the Army kept him in because they desperately needed smart people like he.
Well, he was just a private first class, but then he had access to almost all the insider information about the U.S. government.
Well, in the wake of 9/11, there was a lot more information sharing between departments of government. And so he would see not only materials about operations in the field in Iraq, which is where he was stationed, but also materials about Afghanistan and also State Department cables.
Was the fact that he was able to download a large amount of classified information without detection pretty remarkable?
It is remarkable, and frankly, one of the things that's not much remarked upon is just how easy that was. Now, I think he was skillful, but I think also it testifies to the military's own problems in these regards. So nobody's been held to account except for Bradley Manning for this.
He says he would bring a disc of songs by Lady Gaga into the computer room. He would erase them and then download all of the stuff onto that disc. It was that easy.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it wasn't quite that easy. He actually logged on a tremendous number of times, but he was able over time to download a fantastic amount of information.
What do you think motivated him to release all of that information to WikiLeaks?
I think it was a sense that there was something deeply wrong. I mean, I don't think he thought too carefully or not carefully enough about how that information would be used, but I think he sensed that there was something deeply wrong with the way the United States was conducting two wars.
Why do you think no one else has been held responsible for the lax security?
I think that's a very good question. I think they want to scapegoat Bradley Manning, is my own personal view. And so they're focusing all the attention on him, and everybody else gets off scot-free.
And a lot of attention is paid to his confusion about his sexual identity. Is that an important part of the story?
Here's why it's important. I think that Bradley Manning was going through a lot of changes, and he was even thinking about changing his sexuality. The mystery...
You mean going through an operation?
Correct. The mystery of this story is why, when Bradley Manning successfully leaked materials to WikiLeaks, did he reach out to somebody else, in this case a gray hat hacker named Adrian Lamo, to tell him all about how he did just that? That is to say, to, in effect, out himself. And one of the reasons he reaches out to Adrian Lamo was because he was bisexual and because he was a hacker. He wanted somebody to talk to. He needed somebody to talk to.
But they'd never met.
They had never met.
And he was pretty open. In fact, at one point in their online conversations, Lamo says that he's a journalist and a church minister and that he'd be able to protect Manning. Was he simply trying to get as much information out of Manning as possible?
He was, and he lied to Manning. I mean, he said everything was, in effect, off the record, when it clearly wasn't off the record. Lamo was the guy who brought this material to the federal authorities.
And you have any idea why he decided to turn Bradley Manning in?
We don't know exactly why. We know from Adrian Lamo that he felt it was his patriotic duty, that this guy had leaked a massive amount of classified data and should be held to account.
He has been vilified by many people. Do you think he has any regrets about his role in this affair?
Adrian Lamo?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he does. I mean, on camera, we see him cry rather.
Well, he looks very uncomfortable all the time. And my first thought was, in no way am I trying to stigmatize him, but I thought, this guy's Asperger's, and he has real problems relating to people.
He does. I mean, he had been treated for Asperger's, and also I think he was heavily medicated in some ways for back pain, and that may have been playing a role.
My guest is Alex Gibney. His latest film, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, opens this Friday, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Alex Gibney, whose latest film is We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. And it opens at a couple of theaters around town, the Angelica, and also the new theater at Lincoln Center.
Correct.
The Eleanor Bunin, what is it?
The Eleanor Bunin. That's how I know it. Right.
It's a wonderful little theater.
Yes, it is.
Now, this film is really not just about Julian Assange and Bradley Manning. It's about a lot of different things and also about the U.S. government. But I was struck by the fact that the film points out there's a lot of irony that these two men, Manning and Assange, who had personal secrets that they wanted to keep from the world, were so dedicated to exposing the secrets of governments.
Indeed. I think that's highly ironic in this story.
And is this something you think that they thought about much?
I think they have. I mean, Julian Assange has thought about it a little bit, but I think it's not so easy. Secrets are tough. Secrets are hard to keep. It's hard to know when to give them up, both personal secrets and political secrets. And in a way, that's what the film is about. It's a messier world than we'd like to think it is.
And later in the story, when Julian Assange is trying to control all of his secrets from being exposed, the idealists who have worked with him in WikiLeaks are disappointed in him. They feel betrayed.
I think so, because he seemed to be transgressing the very ideals which he seemed to espouse. I mean, in one instance, he has a lot of his followers sign an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, which is often used to silence whistleblowers. The penalty thereof would be $12 million. So that was, that seems an odd thing for a transparency organization to require of its members.
And kind of silly, because none of those people probably had $1,200.
Correct.
WikiLeaks created a system which enables people to leak anonymously. How did that change the traditional way that journalists obtain leaked information from sources?
Well, to be honest, I'm not
sure. This is not a deep throat kind of thing, meeting in a garage.
No, but to be honest, I'm not sure that ultimately it did. I started this film thinking it was about that kind of new technology that would change everything. I think in the wake of this that actually that technology is not nearly as important as the other thing he did, meaning Julian Assange, which was to find a transnational way of publishing. Because it turns out that despite the anonymity of that machine, Bradley Manning's identity was ultimately revealed because he needed a human connection. So I think there's a lot to be said for the old system of sources leaking to journalists in ways that they have a personal relationship.
Well, WikiLeaks first really became began to make headlines when it posted a video showing a U.S. military helicopter gunning down a Reuters journalist and some unnamed companions in Iraq, and then they killed members of a family who'd come to help them. Hadn't part of that story already been known?
It had. In fact, a transcript of the dialogue from the helicopter pilots had been published in a book called The Good Soldiers by David Finkel.
We had him on the show to talk about that.
Right. And so it's interesting because the government said when Reuters complained and wanted to see the videotape, they said, sorry, that videotape is classified. And yet in the context of a journalist who was embedded, it was somehow okay or allowable for that transcript to be revealed.
But so, it's shocking to look at that footage, which you include in your film.
It is, and I think the military understands that the visual imagery and the audio is far more shocking than it was in print. And it's one of the things, for example, that so concerned the United States government in the wake of Abu Ghraib, for example.
So after that created a stir, did that inspire Julian and the people who were working with him to go after more and more important stories?
Sure. But I think it also must be understood that collateral murder, that so-called video, or that's the shortened version of that onboard video of a helicopter gunship strike, that plus the State Department cables, plus the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs, they all came from one source, Bradley Manning.
But then they wound up being released to the New York Times, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel. They could have just been put on the internet.
They could have. But I think Julian sensed properly that there were two things he would gain by working with the New York Times, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel. One was exposure, because he was a rather obscure website. And two was some kind of political protection, because these are very well-established organizations in their own constituencies. So it was, I think, important for him to do that.
Well, wasn't there a fair amount of disagreement between Assange and a number of the reporters that he worked with?
Yes. I think the biggest disagreement was over this issue of redactions. And Julian Assange initially didn't want to do any redactions whatsoever.
He said he had some kind of a program that automatically redacted names. But when these things were released, none of the names had been redacted.
He had held back, I believe it was about 15,000 of the Afghan war logs. But in the ones that he did publish, there were quite a number of names.
And why doesn't he believe in redactions? Isn't he aware that would leave him open to charges of aiding the enemy?
I'm not sure that he was sufficiently aware of the kind of political damage that could be done, how he would lose his political immunity by not redacting that material, because that's precisely what happened. That's when the U.S. government was able to isolate Julian Assange from these journalistic organizations and say, he's the problem, he's different.
Well, we've seen in the past when the names of CIA operatives have been released, this is way before WikiLeaks, that some of them were killed. So they're all open. They want to be open targets.
Indeed. Now, we're almost certain that nobody was killed as a result of these names being released. However, the fact that they could have been killed is the problem. That creates the political problem, and it's what allowed Assange to be isolated from these other organizations.
And after the stories were published, he became the Times and so the other papers kind of turned on Assange and WikiLeaks.
I think the Times, the New York Times in particular, turned on him in a rather unfortunate way. They went after him in a very sort of small-minded, personal way, you know, insulting his personal appearance, the fact that he didn't bathe. They really went out of their way to, I would say, vilify him personally, which I found unfortunate.
The Obama administration has charged more people with leaking information than all the previous White Houses combined. Why do you think this administration has taken such a strong stance against whistleblowing? And then there's the whole matter that you deal with in this film, the nature of Manning's detention, which has become particularly controversial and actually came up at a presidential news conference.
I think the way the Obama administration has handled whistleblowers and has handled Bradley Manning is outrageous in the extreme. And I can't say exactly why the Obama administration promised to be the most transparent administration in history.
Well, you spoke to people in the administration. What did they say?
Well, they said that's our policy. That's our stance. But in fact, they did just the opposite. I mean, they've prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all previous administrations combined.
And that's an Espionage Act from 1917.
Correct. It was used to prosecute Daniel Ellsberg, by the way, but that was thrown out of court because of the rather abusive practices of the Nixon administration going after a psychiatrist, et cetera.
I'm talking with Alex Gibney about his latest film, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In your director's statement about the film, you said, "I discovered that the film is about how vulnerable we all are." What did you mean by that?
Well, I think vulnerable we all are in terms of our own secrets online. I mean, I think that, you know, the United States government routinely catches in a big net all of our emails and phone conversations. And that may come as a surprise to some people, but that's what happens. They don't always look at them, but they're capable of looking at them if they feel like they might want to. And also there are hackers out there who sometimes invade your privacy by getting materials that you might not want them to have. So our secrets are very vulnerable now.
So do we become someone else when we are on the internet?
Well, that's a question. And in a way, that's one of the questions that the film asks. Who are we when we're on the internet? Are we ourselves or are we somebody else?
And there's been a lot of talk about how some people who have trouble relating to others wind up very comfortable on the internet. Do you think that's true of Assange and Manning?
Yes, I do. And I think that they can assume different kinds of personalities and they can be who they want to be on the internet. And it's peculiar, but there's a staggering amount of intimacy that goes on the internet between people who've never met. I find that really interesting.
Talking about intimacy, you spoke to the two women who have accused Assange of sexual assault. What were their allegations?
Well, I only spoke to one of the women.
And you had to disguise her face because she's afraid of being attacked?
She has been attacked by supporters of Assange. In fact, we show in the film online images of her face with a bullseye on it. Her face can be seen on the internet, but the fact was she was concerned on a day-to-day basis that she not want to be recognized in the street because she's been the subject of a tremendous amount of abuse. Ultimately, she agreed to speak not on the actual facts of the case, but on her position in all of this and how hard it's been for her, because when Julian Assange went into the Ecuadorian embassy, suddenly she felt that she might never have her day in court.
There are two images of these women. One is that they were volunteers, groupies, in effect, who wound up voluntarily, you know, wanting to have consensual sex with Assange, but it was what happened during the sex that caused them trouble. And others have called them CIA operatives who were involved in a sting, and they have been called all sorts of other things.
Correct. Well, and I think the great wrong that Julian Assange did was to encourage this idea that they were part of some CIA conspiracy, even though he had no evidence of that. At one point in the film, he says, "I'm not saying it's a honey trap. I'm not saying it is not a honey trap," which is a clever way of kind of seeding that idea in the minds of everybody. Oh, my God, a CIA conspiracy.
And is that because you think he actually believes it, or because that's a way of defending himself against actions that many people would consider rather reprehensible on his part?
I think it started out as the former, and then ultimately I think he may have come to believe it, that he's caught in some giant web set for him by the spider of the U.S. government.
Well, doesn't he have children from a number of women all over the world?
Yes, he does. And it's mentioned in the film in passing as a way of saying that these allegations of having sex without a condom and possibly intentionally breaking the condom in having sex with another woman may have been something that was a kind of pattern in his behavior. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying it's possible.
Well, he could have just gone to Sweden and faced the charges and said this didn't happen, and he probably would have had a good chance of winning the case.
Correct.
He's seen as a hero by an awful lot of people, and especially in a country as liberal as Sweden.
It's hard for me to understand why he didn't go back. I think in part he became entranced by his own fiction, the idea that this was part of a honey trap. And he's become convinced that if he goes back to Sweden, he'll somehow be extradited to the United States and, as his lawyer once said, promptly sent to Guantanamo, which I think is ridiculous.
In some sense, has Assange been his own worst enemy, do you think?
Yes. Though I do think at a certain point, his strategy of conflating the Swedish story with the transparency agenda made him much more famous in the short term. But then he got caught in his own fiction.
At its height, how many people worked for WikiLeaks?
I don't know. I've never seen a number, but honestly, the it was always a very small organization, just a few people.
And you have a few of the ones who were most involved on camera in this film, true believers for quite a while, and then ultimately disillusioned.
Correct. One, Daniel Domscheit-Berg, a German who started out with Julian very early on in the organization, and then another named James Ball, who's now a Guardian reporter, who was, when Julian Assange went into hiding, a kind of de facto press representative for WikiLeaks.
And Assange seems to have turned on both of them.
He has. I mean, Julian Assange takes a very dim view of people who say critical things about him. And so anybody who says critical things about him, he turns on very quickly.
Even if there's obvious truth to what they are saying. Both of them were strong supporters, believed until they were forced to change their minds.
True believers. I think they really wanted to believe in WikiLeaks. But Julian Assange believes that the end justifies the means, that he is afflicted, I think, with what James Ball refers to in the film as noble cause corruption. If your cause is noble, you are allowed to do bad things.
Let's talk a bit about top secret security. According to Dana Priest and William Arkin of the Washington Post, there are something like 850,000 U.S. government employees who have top secret security clearances. That makes it sound to me like our classification system is out of control.
I would agree. I think our classification system is out of control. In fact, Bill Leonard, who was the classification czar in the Bush administration, says as much. You know, there's supposed to be a mandate that you can be sanctioned for improperly classifying materials, but it's never been used. So as a result, secrets are proliferating. I remember when I went to Guantanamo for another film I did, Taxi to the Dark Side, we were pointing our camera at the landscape, and somebody said, sorry, you can't photograph that. That mountain is classified.
In fact, they could stamp top secret on practically anything, can't they?
And seemingly they do.
Are the things that Assange is trying to point out about the size of the national security state ultimately going to be overlooked because of his personal troubles?
I hope not. I mean, I think people have to learn to distinguish between these issues. Assange's crime was conflating them. I think we need to separate them. There are some very important issues here, and I think the overreach of the national security state is deeply concerning. And the abusive treatment of Bradley Manning and the attempt to hold him to account with a charge of, quote unquote, aiding the enemy, which could lead to his death, is outrageous in my view.
It's pointed out in your film that governments now have tremendous power to spy on their citizens, but it's also relatively easy for citizens to steal information from those governments and to leak it. Does that fact make you hopeful about the future?
No, it makes me concerned. And frankly, I think the solution here is not a technical solution. The solution is a moral one. I think people on both sides, both the side of the government and the side of those who might want to leak government secrets, need to behave in a more moral fashion. And that means finding a way to come to some agreement about what should and should not be secret.
The film notes that 60,000 phone calls and emails are intercepted by intelligence agencies every second.
Yes, that's correct.
That makes me feel like there's very little privacy.
There isn't. I mean, the fact is they're gathering this material in this huge net. And then when certain things happen, like, say, the Boston explosion recently, you know, they look for keywords and other things. So this has been rather well documented by James Bamford in his books on the NSA.
On the other hand, the Boston Marathon bombing, because there were security cameras around, we found them relatively quickly. And there are many people who are now saying they'd love to see security cameras everywhere.
I think that we have to make certain decisions about how much these things, you know, how we regulate these things. Because the fact of the matter is, when a government has that much power to surveil, and sometimes they are using that surveillance to protect us, which I think is right and proper. But there need to be checks and balances so the government can't operate with impunity and use those secrets against us in ways that are reprehensible.
Why has the Ecuadorian government, of all governments, rather corrupt one, as I understand it, given Assange asylum, in effect?
I don't know exactly why. I suspect it was because it was a good publicity stunt. They're able to tout their anti-American credentials in a neighborhood where that is valuable.
Because now they're part of a little three governments are doing that, Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador.
That's right. And so they look good. I mean, the fact is Julian Assange met the president of Ecuador on his chat show for Russian television. It's like the ironies here get too rich.
Alex Gibney's latest film, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, just filled with all sorts of wonderful and complicated stories, opens this Friday. And it has been my great pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Len.